Hi, Dan.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Can't complain. A little busy. Well,
you're one of the few people in the anywhere near Wall Street who can't right now. I should say you're Dan Gross, the business columnist for both Slate and Newsweek, I guess, and I'm Robert Wright. And I this week I was trying to make sense of this financial apocalypse thing, and I thought, who better to explain to me how it happened and what it means than the person who's been called America's finest business writer?
That was my mother who called me that, so I don't know if you can...
I knew it was somebody, I just couldn't remember. I couldn't remember who. But anyway, she's a woman known for her her judgment. But the other qualification you have is that you can actually tell us why this is good, right? Because since lining this up with you yesterday, I remembered you wrote the book called... Would you care to give us the title?
Pop, Why Bubbles Are Great for the Economy.
Just out
in Chinese, by the way.
Is that right?
Just in time for that economy to tank.
Just as the wave of panic is spreading across
right.
the Pacific, they are there to realize that the Buddha had it wrong. It's not that life is suffering. It's all good. It's all good.
It's all good in the long term.
And you should, you know, you should, maybe you can pick up a little money writing speeches for John McCain, by the way.
Do they pay? What's their per word rate?
Actually, I think they're kind of changing their tune on how wonderful the economy is anyway. I think you missed your moment there, Dan.
Okay.
But anyway, so let's see. A lot has happened. First of all, a while ago, the government bailed out Bear Stearns. Then it kind of bailed out Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Then it declined to bail out Lehman Brothers, and then it did bail out AIG, this big, largely insurance company, right? Do I have it right so far?
Yeah, but, you know, I think this bailout, the term bailout is sort of overused. You know, Bear Stearns was not technically bailed out. You know, their stock was going down. It was down at 2. The government basically made it possible for J.P. Morgan, another bank, to take over Bear Stearns by presenting some of Bear Stearns' junky assets as collateral. So the loan was actually made to J.P. Morgan, enabling them to take over Bear Stearns. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, again, the investors were not bailed out because the government took them over, and those stocks are pretty close to zero. It was the debt holders there that were bailed out. Lehman Brothers, nobody got bailed out. It just went Chapter 11, and there the debt holders are suffering. And now with AIG... you can say this is a bailout, but the government is going to exact a price for this. You and I, Bob, will likely be the proud owners of 80% of what was, until a couple days ago, a member of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The taxpayers...
Now I see what you mean about it being all good. I'm the owner of a major company.
There you go. And, you know, you may be... I would nominate you for the board of directors, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, it could be new policy that they provide some copies of your books to every AIG policyholder, of which there are hundreds of thousands. So
they might want to make a strategic investment in Brainwave TV, the company that owns Blogging Heads, but we can talk to them about that later. Now that I'm a stockholder, I shouldn't have trouble getting them to return my phone calls. What did happen though in all these cases, right, is our tax dollars we're kind of put on the line.
Exactly.
I mean, as long as nobody calls the bluff, we're okay, I guess. But it is because of the confidence people have in the American government and its financial backing, i.e., you and me, that these things worked, I guess.
Right. And each of these, you know, I think the reason they do call it a bailout is because in every instance, management and the market at large essentially sort of threw up their hands and said, this company, these companies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Bear Stearns, Lehman, AIG, they cannot make it on their own in this, you know, shark-infested place that we call the public markets, and mm-hmm. in which these companies had, you know, really thrived and in many instances helped dominate in the last several years. So a really stunning fall for these companies.
Now, as you describe what happened, I realized that I guess that the government deserves credit for, in a way, succeeding in having it both ways. That is to say, give the companies enough support so that they don't fail without not punishing the shareholders. I mean, there is this famous problem called moral hazard. In a capitalist system, you actually want people to make bad who make bad bets to suffer. It's part of the learning process, and it keeps us all trying to be smart investors and not putting money in stupid places. It sounds like in this case, the shareholders have, in all of the cases of these so-called bailouts, suffered, right?
Well, they were suffering before the bailout happened. You know, the Bear Stearns people got $10 per share. That didn't go to zero. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac is probably pretty close to zero. Lehman Brothers, close to zero. AIG remains to be seen what happens. But, you know, there's a sort of weird hierarchy here where we say we don't want the shareholders, you know, the people who bought stock, to be bailed out and helped because that would encourage moral hazard. But, mm-hmm. you know, there are also all sorts of people who have claims on these companies, namely the debt holders, people who bought their bonds and preferred shares. And within that, there are all types of, you know, there's subordinated debt. There's a whole hierarchy from senior to junior debt of people who are on the hook when these guys fail. And those are the people who were bailed out, in essence. Their mm-hmm. debts, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, all the people who bought those bonds, trillions of dollars of bonds that they issued, the government is now saying that they're going to be made whole. And the real difference here, I think one of the determining factors of whether, you know, of who shall live and who shall die.
And so far, Lehman is the one that the government has left to fend for itself, and the right?
Right. And, you know, uh-huh. J.P. Morgan agreed to basically take on the debt of Bear Stearns. But what determines it is if a lot of people out there in the world, especially central banks and big financial authorities, if they hold a lot of your debt and the U.S. government is really worried about the implications of that debt going bad, that's right. when we'll come in and provide the backstop. And that was clearly the case with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, where foreign central banks of, you know, China, our big trading partners, owned literally hundreds of billions of dollars of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bonds, not the stock, mm-hmm. but these bonds uh-huh. that we could, for geopolitical reasons, could not simply not afford to let those go bad.
And so, as you pointed out in a Slate piece, this has the ironic property of encouraging the government to rush to the defense of the companies that have been the least responsible. In other words, Bear Stearns, I think it was you said, had an extremely high ratio of debt to equity. And you might think that that's a hallmark of reckless management, but by the same token, it's one of the things that made it too big to fail. In other words, there were a lot of people. It's the reason that its collapse could have been contagious, because there were so many people that it owed money to, right?
Right. The lesson is to, you know, go heavy or don't go at all. I mean, maybe a good metaphor is if you put up, you know, out in Princeton, New Jersey, in a field somewhere, and you put up a three-story office building, and your, you know, engineer was drunk and your architect was blind and the whole thing was a mess and it was starting to fall.
That actually happened, by the way. That's where I am right now, but go ahead.
And it started to fall. The authorities would kind of let it crumble because nobody would really, you know, aside from the people who spent money building it, would be hurt. But if I go in Midtown and I build an 80-story building planted amid all these other skyscrapers, and I had mm-hmm. an incompetent engineer and a blind architect and a drunk construction manager, and this thing starts to look like it's going to fall over and destroy Rockefeller Center, destroy Central Park, and kill thousands of people, well, of course, all the authorities are going to come running and do everything they can to stop that from happening. And I mm-hmm. think that the equivalent is what happened with the financial world, where if your incompetence was merely going to bring you down, you can fail. But if your incompetence mm-hmm. was going to bring all sorts of other people around the world down, then something had to be done. And again, AIG was a case of that as well, this huge insurance company that had these, you know, strange and manifold financial connections to financial institutions all around the world.
So although Lehman must not be a model of brilliant management if it was if it kind of found itself in bankruptcy, nonetheless, you might say it was relatively responsible compared to Bear Stearns, and that's the reason Bear Stearns got bailed out and Lehman didn't. I mean, Bear Stearns had racked up more debt.
Yes, and there was also this sense that, you know, Lehman Brothers, after Bear Stearns went down, the Federal Reserve started extending credit to investment banks who had never been part of the system. You know, they're not regulated. they had traditionally not been allowed to go up and present their assets for collateral and borrow from the Federal Reserve. After Bear Stearns, the Federal Reserve opened that discount window, as they call it, to investment banks like Lehman. So, you know, the attitude in Washington was like, Lehman has had 6 months, and they've had access to this capital in the meantime. They've had every opportunity to get lower leverage. They could have sold off some of their assets, like Neuberger Berman, which is a big mutual fund company that could have raised several billion dollars. They had all this time to take evasive action, and their CEO, for a variety of reasons, you know, who had spent his whole career there, who was very intertwined with the firm, saw himself as the image of the firm, was unwilling to make the tough decisions.
Yeah. So speaking of selling subsidiaries and things, I've been trying to imagine, you know, there's been talk of, you know, Lehman will have to liquidate, and there was even a picture in the paper of some employee walking around with their box of, you know, desktop stuff, you know, as if they were packing it in. But I assume it's, by and large, what's happening is not you fire all the employees immediately, sell the office equipment, and that's the end of it, right? I mean, they will sell off divisions, I gather, while they have the protection of bankruptcy, right?
Right. I mean, the beauty of Chapter 11 bankruptcy is that whoever acquires you is not responsible for your debt. So already, Lehman Brothers Investment Banking unit has been acquired by Barclays, which is a big London-based bank, which has long wanted a bigger presence in New York, for about $1.7 billion. So they are getting Lehman's office buildings and those businesses and those employees. So that's around 9 or 10,000 of the 25,000 Lehman Brothers employees right there who, you know, showing up for work, continuing to do their job, but will have a new owner rather quickly. And there are these other chunks like Neuberger Berman, which is a mutual fund and money management company, that will likely be sold intact to another buyer relatively soon. So it's not like Enron, where, you know, it went bankrupt and then literally everybody was out on the street the next day.
And yet, the fear was that, well, you tell me. I mean, it makes it sound like, why didn't they do this with Bear Stearns? If ultimately most of their liabilities wind up being inherited with the various companies that buy the chunks, in other words, somebody becomes responsible for the debts, right?
No, once you fire for Chapter 11, if the, you know, there's this sort of carcass, there's the estate, and so they get paid, you know, the estate gets paid $2 billion for selling this asset, then they have to pay all the claims based out of that. And if the, you know, the senior debt, certain types of bondholders get paid first, but they might only get pennies on the dollar, and then the junior bondholders might get less so, and then the stockholders, if there's anything left over there, they get something, and if they're very lucky, they might get a penny or two on the dollar. So, you know, there is this process by which it is managed in Chapter 11 on behalf of all the people it owed money to, and they try to maximize their recoveries by selling things.
Okay. So,
but the
if they had done this with Bear Stearns and let it go into bankruptcy, there just would have still been, like, from their point of view, too many debtors on the hook.
Right. And that has something to do with this thing called credit default swaps, which are CDS, which is a sort of monster that arose in recent years. And basically, it's a market for people basically taking bets on other people's credit worthiness. Say, Bob, that you think the New York Times, you know, might fail next year, but you own some of their bonds. Well, you might want to buy insurance from me on $1 million of those bonds. So you'll pay me a couple thousand dollars a year, and I will ensure that, you know, if those bonds default, I will pay you, Bob Wright, $1 million. And so you and I are now counterparties to a credit default swap. Bear Stearns was a counterparty to trillions of those types of credit default swaps on all types of arrangements, bets, companies around the world. And the fear was that if they went bankrupt, if one side of that swap is no longer good for the money, if they think that they can't pay off in the event of a default, then that whole contract, the value of that contract will plummet in value, and the person on the other side of it will have to write down the value of it, and all of a sudden now they have an issue with their assets and everything else. This is an unregulated, so-called over-the-counter market. There's no central exchange. There's no way of knowing who has what exposure to what. And that's one of the real big messes and tangles that has to be unwound in the next several months.
Right. I mean, you pointed out in a recent Slate piece, I think, that I mean these investment banks are just relatively unregulated compared to commercial banks. Did I correctly infer from your piece that there's just no limit on what on the ratio of, say, their equity to their debt? I mean, there is a limit for how much commercial banks can leverage the actual cash sitting in the bank, right? What the ratio of loans they can issue to that is. But is there no regulation in the case of investment banks of that nature at all?
Not really, no. It's really between them and the world, between them and the capital markets, between them and their borrowers. You know, Bear Stearns was at 33-1. They had $33 of debt outstanding for every $1 of cash they had. Lehman Brothers wasn't all that much better. And even today, the big ones are in the 20s. Now, you know, a federal bank, the first National Bank of Princeton, if one exists, you know, it's part of the FDIC system. Its deposits are insured. Its books get examined every year by a federal regulator who says, you know, you got to keep it. You got to have $1 of deposits or cash on hand for every $10 of debt you have. And if you go below that ratio, you're going to be in trouble, and we're going to have special surveillance over you because we, the regulator, we don't want to be responsible for making your depositors whole. So the irony is that the regulated components of the financial services sector have done much better than the unregulated components because they were forced by the discipline of the regulator to run less debt. Now, in theory, the discipline of the marketplace should be, you know, have a heavier hammer because that is, you know, in real time and people over the world constantly making judgments about how much you should be able to borrow. But because there was a lack of transparency, because it was hard for people to know precisely what Bear Stearns had out there, that market discipline didn't work. And so you have enormous amounts of credit, all the credit in the world you can want, until that day when the market says, you know, we don't want to give you any anymore.
Now, well, this could extend to a kind of ideological argument. I assume it will, that people on the left will say we needed more regulation. And actually, it is true, is it not, that the McCain advisor famously fired, basically, for saying America's a nation of whiners and the only recession we have is a mental recession, i.e. Phil Graham. He did. He was a sponsor of legislation that I don't think has been especially linked to this, but was in fact part of a series of deregulating things, which was put an end to Glass-Steagall, right? Which had,
right.
Well, in a way, this is the reason Bank America can buy a broker, an investment bank now, and it bought Merrill Lynch to get it off the hook, is because Glass-Steagall's not in effect. Phil Graham was sponsored the bill, I think, that got rid of Glass-Steagall, but I don't think that's been especially implicated in this particular thing. But to what extent? I mean, what ideological finger pointing could legitimately ensue here, right? I mean,
well,
are there specific pieces of deregulation that seem to have been responsible, or even overly burdensome regulation? I mean, some people say that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the problem was too much government. With the government kind of pretending as if, you know, it's a free lunch. The government's behind this stuff. Borrow all you want, you know. So in general, how do you see the ideology playing out?
Well, I think the politics of this are tricky. Normally, you would think, that this is great. The Democrats, this is red meat for them. Here, there's corrupt Wall Streeters and the Republicans who are doing their bidding. But of course, you know, the momentum for deregulation of Wall Street was very bipartisan in the 1990s. We forget, you know, Bob Rubin was the Treasury Secretary. When Glass-Steagall was effectively eroded, when Citigroup was acquired by Travelers in 1998, and then the following year Congress passed the law that did away with that and said commercial banks and investment banks can coexist. This was something that was backed by Alan Greenspan, the iconic chairman of the Federal Reserve. It was backed by the Clinton administration, which happily signed it, on the advice of plenty of the Wall Street figures who served in that administration. many Democrats, especially what I call the sort of hedge fund Democrats, you know, Chuck Schumer, Chris Dodd, people who represent Connecticut and New York, who are very close to the financial services industry, they wanted that legislation, and of course, virtually all the Republicans did as well. So it's as tempting as it is to blame Phil Graham for this, because he is a pretty unattractive political creature. He says to say the tend to say the wrong thing. You know, there's plenty of bipartisan blame to go around on the big deregulation question, and on the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, these government-sponsored enterprises, which are always called upon to do two conflicting things. One was to stimulate the ownership of housing, and the other was to make a profit for their shareholders. And here, you know, those were much more Democratic institutions than Republican ones. Former CEOs include Franklin Raines, who was the director of the OMB under Clinton, Guy Johnson, who was a top advisor to John Kerry. There were a lot of Democrats serving at those companies, and the relevant people in Congress were always agitating for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to do more. So the ideology is one thing. The partisan politics doesn't shake out how you might think.
And how are the two presidential candidates trying to make it shake out? I haven't caught that much of this. I mean, of course, broadly speaking, Obama's trying to depict McCain as out of touch with the economic suffering, and McCain does give him the occasional assist here by sounding like Herbert Hoover, the fundamentals are, you know, they're sound and so on. And then McCain, for his part, though, I heard lately playing a, first of all, he's quit saying the economy, the fundamentals are sound, and he's also playing a kind of a populist card, blaming greed on Wall Street. I mean, this is the first time I've seen any kind of convergence between the worldviews of Oliver Stone and John McCain, but here it is.
Well, I was thinking more like William Jennings Bryan, thou shalt not crucify mankind on a cross of gold.
On a cross of gold.
There is that element of, you know, I think they have both crudely tried to fit these happenings into their kind of narratives, or even their meta-narratives, if you will. For McCain, you know, he's a reformer. He battles corruption. Corruption annoys him and angers him. Earmarks are corrupt. Congress is corrupt. He's going to clean it up. Why are we in this trouble? Because there was this corrupt, casino-like, gambling, unethical type of behavior on Wall Street, and now everybody's paying the price. For Obama, he says, well, this is just the latest, you know, this is shows the failure of 8 years of economic philosophy, of deregulation, give tax breaks to the rich, etc. In reality, giving tax breaks to the rich really has not that much to do with what's been going on. And, you know, corruption, you know, I guess I would distinguish between greed and corruption. Corruption and Washington corruption has relatively little to do with what happened at Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. So I think so far they have, to my mind, not been particularly successful in talking about the root causes of these things and fitting them into their campaign narratives. But that's what they're trying to do. They're really trying to, I think, clumsily kind of smack these round cylindrical shapes into a square hole.
And what do you think the accurate diagnosis is of what went wrong? Of course, you're a noted fan of the bursting of bubbles yourself, as reflected in the title of your book, Pop, Why Bubbles Are Great for the Economy. So maybe you think nothing went wrong, but probably you think, notwithstanding, I mean, I guess, well, maybe in the course of this, you should tell us what your argument is about the virtues of bubbles. But so I would combine that question with the question of what your diagnosis is here. What, to the extent that even you would say something went wrong here, what went wrong?
Incompetence, greed, and the exact same mentality that we've seen in bubbles going back to the 19th century, which is a kind of a groupthink, a sense that there are new economic assumptions, that you throw out the old models, that bad things don't happen, that if something succeeds once, it can succeed 25 times. You take it to the nth degree, you run with it over the cliff. The argument why bubbles are good, you know, in my book I look at financial ones, but also ones that resulted in the creation of new infrastructure, the railroad, the telegraph, the internet. And the argument there is that, you know, we always tell the story as one of this kind of moral decline, and the story always ends in 2001 when the NASDAQ is down and we think the dot-com era was a joke. It ends when all the railroads were bankrupt in the 1890s. And, you know, the story of the impact of these new developments on the economy didn't really stop there. If you roll it forward, you know, Google, YouTube, MySpace, the way we all use the internet, what you and I are doing right now was a business and business model that was built on the wreckage of the 1990s. All that excess capacity made lots of users, made things very cheap so that when people came along and wanted to start a business on the platform of the internet, they could plug into tens of millions of users and create new businesses that were not imagined during the bubble itself. Same thing happened with the telegraph and with the railroad. When you have a bubble that doesn't leave behind the physical infrastructure, when the bubble's just in paper, as a lot of this credit was, it takes longer to unwind, and it's harder for somebody to come in and use this platform, use the stuff that was left over, use that excess capacity for a new type of business. So there's a distinction.
But you would say to some extent those virtues are in the long run present even in a real estate bubble? In other words, you would say,
yes.
Well, look at all these buildings that you can't lease out now. Nonetheless, they'll right. be there when we need them. That would be your argument?
Well, Americans process failure very quickly, especially compared with the Japanese and Europeans. So, yeah, a condo that is built won't sell. Someone will use it for a hotel. They'll use it for an office, for a college dormitory. They don't just sit there unused. They get taken over by new owners with different capital bases and maybe with a different idea of what to do with it. But, you know, in my book, I talk about the physical infrastructure, which would be houses or, you know, the internet system itself, and then what I call the mental infrastructure. A lot of that is built during bubbles, which is lots of money is spent on hype and promotion, convincing people to try new things, to trade stocks online, to buy books online, to blog, to do things in the new media and environment. And that mentality sticks around after the bubble bursts, so that when you come along in 2003 and you want to sell some stuff to people online, they're comfortable. They have the mentality to do that. When you look at the mental infrastructure that arose during this last bubble, this whole culture of refinancing, you know, a lot of people got hurt. A lot of people did extraordinarily well refinancing their mortgages, just switching from a fix to a fix. I know people that did it 5 or 6 times, and every time effectively saving tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars over the lifetime of a loan. That mentality won't go away. And some of the businesses, Zillow and Domania, these online services that kind of give you information about how much your neighbors paid for their house, make you a better consumer, make you a more effective buyer and seller of real estate, those aren't going to get torn down. Those will be useful to people. But, you know, when the bubble pops, it's always when it's most difficult to contemplate what the positive could be. In 01, if I had told you that there's this company called Google, and in 7 years everybody will use it, and it will have a $200 billion market capitalization, and it will be immensely profitable, that would have sounded like a joke.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, of course, any physical or intellectual residue, I guess, will be put to use, more or less. But still, wouldn't it be better if instead of massively overinvesting in certain areas, I mean, in other words, look, if people hadn't been investing in tech stocks
right.
in late 2000 and had been investing in, well, let's, I don't know whether they were also investing in pharmaceuticals, they probably were, but let's say they weren't, and that's the trade-off, right? There is a trade-off. Let's say they invested in the tech stocks, they could have been investing in pharmaceuticals. I mean, you know, who's to say? It seems to me it would have been better to invest in something that actually had more near-term demand.
Absolutely.
It's certainly not clear to me that all the areas of investment that were all the areas of innovation that were deprived of money by the diversion of money into tech stocks wouldn't have, on balance, you know, created a better world if they had been nourished. I don't think that last sentence made any sense. But go ahead.
You're absolutely right, and the thing is that's just not how Americans roll. I mean, you know, one of the critics of my book said, you know, economics is about the efficient allocation of resources.
Right.
And, you know, anyone who studies American history realizes that, you know, our economics is all about the inefficient allocation of resources. There, you know, this mythical world where people rationally, where the system as a whole allocates the precise amount of capital that should go to every sector, that's never been how this country developed. We've had a series of these bubbles propelled by enthusiasm, and I think, you know, Americans are in some ways wired to lose our heads over things.
That's why we rushed off into the wilderness.
So we all go chasing after the hot new area. And the alternative, if you look at Europe, for example, and the way they rolled out new technology where the state comes in at an earlier stage and they string up one telegraph wire from, you know, Munich to Berlin and build one railroad from Paris to Lyon. It's a slower, more rational process, but it doesn't happen as quickly, and you don't get some of these knock-on effects that we've had.
Yeah, but there is the downside. I mean, it seems to me there's a difference between saying this is the way it has to be so long as Americans are crazy and saying, and it's good. It's good, you know, that Americans are crazy. I mean,
I think we're all aware of the downside, and that's what, you know, whenever there is one of these things, the books always get written about the downside. I have a stack of 40 books about the downside that were all, you know, commissioned and written in 2000 and 2001 about the downside of the internet.
Right.
The dot-com revolution, but I think that's, you know, in the scheme of things, that's only going to be half the story.
Mm-hmm. But if you could magically write some legislation that in the future would make it much less likely that people would take out mortgages, either that just, you know, if they had looked forward a few years, they'd realize they couldn't pay, or that were premised on the infinite increase in housing values that would permit them to refinance. I mean, if you could magically make it so that people would behave a little more rationally in that respect, and maybe even legislate to make the stupidity, you know, a little harder to exercise, don't you think that would be a better world? I mean, it seems to me that the world of tech investment and this world of, you know, homeowners investing beyond their means are kind of two different worlds. I mean, wouldn't you support a reflective analysis of kind of what legislation could make the mortgage market a little more rational and make people make it harder to do totally stupid things?
I guess, but I think, you know, I'm skeptical in the end of ways to legislate. You know, what you're talking about is legislating against stupid behavior, right? Unless you want the government to say, okay, you can only buy a house with 10% down, or you have to put a certain amount down, or only people with a certain amount of, you know, there has to be a certain amount of ratio between your assets and the house you buy. Well, what if some person wants, you know, they really are into their house, they don't want to buy a car, and they want to spend, you know, 95% of their assets on that house instead of 85% as the law prescribes. Why should not they be able to do that? Plenty of them would do that and turn out okay. So,
well, I know you're going to have to go soon, you said, but one thing I'd say to that is I don't think you can analyze it only in terms of the consequences to them. In other words, I agree, more or less, people should be free to mess up their lives as long as they don't mess up other people's lives in the process. It seems to me that in this case, the easy access to these mortgages was a big thing behind the inflation of real estate prices that then victimized everyone. In a sense, the collective effect of the individually dubious mortgages made those mortgages even more dubious, if you see what I mean.
Yep. I think the one potential solution is for people in the financial services sector to pay into a kind of, you know, bubble or stupidity insurance, whatever you want to call it, because they would have all said at the height of this, oh, there's no way we're going to ever need or force anyone to stake a claim on public assets because of our stupid lending behavior. But that's precisely what happened. If all along, every time a mortgage was made, a few dollars went into this some sort of insurance fund for a potential bailout down the road, I think we'd be in better shape. And that's clearly what, you know, that's what the banks do with their deposit insurance. I think it's what the investment banks need to do going forward. This notion that we know that you financial companies are going to innovate your way to get people to do stupid things with their money, and in doing so may end up costing us all a lot of money, so we should make you pay into some sort of, buy some sort of insurance on that. And with that, Bob, I have to go.
Okay. Listen, thank you, Dan.
Anytime.
My final quick thought is there's also the problem of the fact that people passing judgment on the mortgages and deciding whether to lend the money were not the people who would bite the dust in the end, and that separation may have been unfortunate. But that's for another day. Thanks for taking
Absolutely.
The time.
Anytime.
See you around.
All right, Bob. Take it easy.
Bye.